The recognition of the ten parts is not the experience of ten. And the experience of the oneness of ten is achieved in the life of man, according to Iamblichus, through the voluntary cooperation of human beings who discover the old adage, in union there is strength. And that these unions create a oneness. When six men are of one mind, there is a oneness. And this oneness is an archetypal entity. And according to the Chaldeans, these archetypal numerical entities are gods. Or, if we wish to look at it otherwise, they enable, through a new body compound, to achieve a release of the common strength of the group. So in the story, as Iamblichus expresses it, there are two ways of approaching this mystery. One is to recognize the possibility of achieving union in the otherwise, or in the otherness. In other words, that we may take blocks on a table and arrange them. We may take 10 tubes of paint and paint one picture with them. This picture is a unity. And this unity is really the instrument of an idea. And in that condition, or in that instance, man himself, as the painter, is the archetypal pressure that is released only through the necessary media or instruments. But the Greek and the Neoplatonists emphasize that these unities, which are so important, may be intellectually known in the otherness, but can never be experienced in the otherness. The only experience of them lies when this entire process of coordinating parts, or the restoring of these divergent numerations, that it must all occur within the individual, not within the world around him. He must experience the unity. And the primary experience arises from the unification of the diversity of his own parts. And that just as surely as evolution must bring him to the gradual unfoldment of his potentials, this law operates through the restoration of unities throughout his body, throughout his emotions, throughout his soul, throughout his mind, throughout his consciousness. And the individual, as the Egyptian in this work says, is dissimilar in his present state, due principally to the fact that he is disunited within his own nature. And that which is in itself divided cannot, in that state, have the experience of being united. It must attain to this experience. It must achieve it. And, of course, in the ancient ritual, the story of initiation, as contained in the Egyptian mysteries to which the old priest referred, was a series of pageantries, dramas, or symbols to impress this upon the neophyte or the candidate. Not so much by things said as by things seen or heard. Not so much by counsel but by mood, by the tremendous stimulation of some internal release of the individual. And a release that is made possible or made suitable by an experience. And therefore, the initiation ritual was totally different from instruction, because in the initiation there was an experience, a participation. There was not this mysterious interval of otherness. The candidate was actually doing these things himself. He was not hearing about them. And this is also involved in the mudras of Indian religion. Because the hand postures, although they are symbolical and in themselves apparently trivial, represent the tremendous difference between learning, listening, reading, and even the simplest gesture of the hand in the actual act of doing. The transformation of a symbol into a living circumstance by the bestowal of internal energy. In this story, therefore, in the development of their level of theurgy, the Neoplatonists emphasized that the great art, the mysterious wisdom revelation which they sought, was not one thing, not one attainable mystery, but was a series of reversals of the involutionary processes by which greater and greater separateness became the burden of human life. And that by reversing this process, man gradually united the various elements and powers of his own nature. As Porphyry and also Sallust, and to a degree the Emperor Julian, points out, that there is as yet no unity in man's sensory perceptions themselves. The eye sees with one purpose, the ear hears with another. Man cannot control his own faculties. He cannot focus them upon a one-purposedness. Therefore, it is perhaps a difficult but necessary thing for him to learn that all of these sensory perceptions are the servants and instruments of an apperceptive power superior to themselves. For as Plotinus points out, unity is always achieved upon a level superior to the diversity. In order to bring things together, in order to circumscribe or bring things within pattern, the individual must transcend their separateness and from a superior state of awareness gather them in. He cannot gather them in directly upon the level of the confusion in which they are separated. This power to gather them in depends, therefore, upon a degree of theurgical insight that is greater than the diversity at any given moment. To achieve this theurgical insight, rationality is not invoked, nor is knowledge regarded as the solution. The solution is always through the experience of the superior. Consequently, the contemplative or mystical disciplines of Neoplatonism begin to assert themselves. The discipline is to use our words, more simple words almost, is to relax into the acceptance of the real. Recognizing that diversity is essentially a state of knowing or a state of not knowing. That diversity for man is a condition arising from his own lack of insight. The primary problem is not that he shall increase in insight, but that he shall no longer increase in failure of insight. In other words, it is not so much in this concept that he grows, as that he ceases to resist growth. Not so much that he knows more, but rather that he begins to experience that which is eternally available in knowing. These terms, even as the old books themselves tell us, very soon become exceedingly complicated, inasmuch as the appropriate name for an experience cannot be found. Once it is experienced, it needs no name, and when it is not experienced, it is useless to name it. Consequently, the problem of the true degree of experience can only be approximated intellectually, and the intellectual approximation is not the attainment of it. The attainment of it lies in the theurgical concept that it must be lived. It must completely and totally possess the being. And the power of man to possess this insight lies not essentially in himself, but in the archetypal eternity of oneness which is at the root of him and within which he exists. Therefore, man's eternal pattern of growth arises from the inevitable impulse of diversity towards its own reunion. And man is on a flowing universal stream that is moving inevitably in this direction. If man resists this motion, he is miserable, he is sick, he is disordered. If great collective parts of mankind resist this motion, they are inevitably destroyed thereby, or at least frustrated and injured. It is therefore the resistance to that which is true or real, which is regarded as the greatest handicap. And in the theurgical part of this mystery, the disciple is taught that if he does not prevent unity, he will experience it. Perhaps that is the nearest way in which I can put it into the words of the original concept as it is given. If the individual does not stand in the way of experience, but is simply quietly receptive of reality. The archetypes move through him. He experiences them, he knows them, because they are of himself. And as in the paragraph which I read, he no longer takes certain things for granted or presumes or assumes or believes. These things move through him when he does not prevent their motion. In our world, however, we are inclined to prevent motions, and it was not so different in the days of Socrates, because the individual, in order to not resent or prevent motion, has to have a certain attitude toward the problem of growth. This attitude lies in the recognition that there is no obstacle but the self, and that all other so-called obstacles are excuses. That the motion of the individual for totality is a completely internal and eternal motion. That it need not be conferred by one upon another, because it is equally present in all things. And as the Egyptian tells us a little later, the stamp of universal or divine being as totality is present in everything from the greatest to the least throughout space. That there is no being, no creature, no existence which in its essential nature does not possess unity. And in possessing unity, possesses the potential of experiencing total existence. Therefore, the obstacle lies not in the inability of the individual to receive instruction, or the ineptitude of the times, or the inconsistency of surrounding circumstances, because unity is present, and its total seal and stamp in everything that exists, from the greatest sun in space to the most minute molecule or ion dancing in a ray of light or energy. These are all totalities, and the totality of each is God, and the totality of the sum is God, and God is the totality of totalities, as the Chaldean oracles are supposed to have said. In this concept, then, the Neoplatonists held that theurgy was the attainment of that which is the inevitable state of man, some achieving it through vigorous attempt, others through absolute self-forgetfulness in the service of other human beings, others less thoughtful, having it slowly thrust upon them by the inevitable vicissitudes of existence. But whether by intent or by circumstance, whether through a tremendous adoration of the divine or an eternal and complete dedication to the human need, the individual is moving constantly toward totality through every moment and instant of self-forgetfulness. The moment he remembers himself, he's lost, as far as the total experience of theurgy is concerned. The moment he is not aware of himself, he begins to depreciate or depress the otherness, because he cannot be hyperly aware of self unless he believes there is something else besides himself. Self is a division. To believe in self is also to recognize isolation from other selves, because self cannot be one and total in equal degree at the same time. So in the Neoplatonic concept, the purpose of self-forgetfulness is represented as the simple means of removing active attitudes which deprive the individual of the immediate apperception of the life moving through him and the archetypes within him. Now, these teachers also fully realize that there is a difference in the obtainable degree of this total experience of unity possible to the individual at a given time. They believe firmly, this book states without equivocation, that this total experience is ultimately available to every creature that exists and is its proper destiny. But the Neoplatonists affirmed that this total experience would not be possible on the same level at a given time in an imperfect and incomplete world to all persons, but that this is in itself no importance, inasmuch as in each instance the experience of unity is a superior experience to the present, and the person of comparatively uncultured attainment who discovers the next superior state of unity in himself has as great and thrilling an experience as the great sage who may experience a much vaster consciousness in this subject. It is all growth. All of this growth is toward totality. And as there are young children who must be taught one thing and older children who must be taught something else, so there are in the world persons, all of whom must react according to their potentials as they are now manifesting. But each one of these is capable, daily, yearly, and through life, to have a series of unfoldings of unity according to his capacity and his knowledge. The carpenter, the shipbuilder, the clerk, the professional man, all of these individuals are capable of gradually unfolding sense of oneness, of identity. Perhaps the physician may first of all begin to recognize a certain unity between himself and the great need of a suffering mankind. He then approaches his subject no longer as a physician making a living, but the experience of the service of a great unity, a concept of identity, a oneness which may be termed health, which may be termed the service of a principle or of a law. And if the physician actually is sincere and is devoted to his cause, the practice of his profession and his faithful service of others will give him an experience of divine unity through the God Asclepius, which is the monad of God as healing and of health. Therefore, he discovers the healing power of the archetypal law through his own ministry. Through whatever we do, we release some indication of the patterns or the great mathematical radiant blossoms described by Plotinus, suspended in being, the wonderful geometric snowflakes of inflexible and inevitable law, which are forever pressing themselves upon creation. To experience these laws, to know them not by the mind, but through a living in them and with them, a gradual possession by them, so that the unity becomes the total or wholeness of the person. So we have Plotinus saying also that each individual, as he grows, presents a sequence of totalities, which is himself. And it is this thing he calls himself that bears witness to the totality he has attained. Because whatever real growth he achieves is not upon himself, toward himself, or for himself, but is himself as part of the unity of the divine power or monad, which is at the root of his own existence. Thus, in all of these procedures, theurgy, as it was taught by the Neoplatonists, comprehends the gradual elimination of otherness and the gradual acceptance of an identity with this gradually unfolding reality. Now, these people lived in times and under circumstances in which world and world's situations were contrary to their deepest and dearest convictions. Thus, perhaps, we may see the reason for the tremendous emphasis which they placed upon a certain of these principles, an emphasis which we find again, of course, in Sallust, in The Gods and the World, and in the hymn of the Emperor Julian to the Mother of the Gods. In these great works, these Neoplatonists pointed out conclusively the transcendent importance of this theurgical mystery, inasmuch as no tyranny of a decadent state could in this way touch the person who possessed the true understanding and the true motive. That it did not require any assistance other than the complete and abiding faith of the individual in the total aspect of universal good. That it was a complete faith in the immutability and inevitability of archetypes that was the final and complete defender and sustainer of the inward life. Either the inward life is sustained by absolute law or it is not. And the Neoplatonists insisted that it was. Therefore, those who break the law, nationally or individually, must ultimately meet a reward or a compensation suitable to their needs, a punishment which is in itself a lesson, and therefore contributes to the ultimate release of the reality through them. But the decadence of worlds and the collapse of cultures could not touch the great archetypes, because these archetypes do not depend upon any human institution for their manifestation. They depend only upon the absolute release, like a blinding flash of eternal radiance, the absolute release of total being through total creation. And that this total creation is gradually achieving this end. Reading one time one of the dialogues of Julian, I happened to go to a motion picture show where they have slowed down the growth of a flower. Or rather, I guess in this case, they speeded it up. In any way, it made it seem as though the flower moved, because they closed down the camera, and in that way made the film appear to transform the plant into an animate thing. In other words, they took a single frame, only so many minutes, so maybe so many hours apart. And then when the sequence was run, it seemed as though the flower opened with a burst of light. And I couldn't help but think of Julian's meditation, relating to the problem of the world, in which he says, or points out, that at any given time, under any given circumstance, there appears to be no motion toward this fullness. That there is no appreciable time in which we can say, this is the day of great rejoicing. That each generation, each day, seems to pass, and the great plan is neglected and ignored. And the otherness prevails. But he also points out that in the great other dimensions of human consciousness, this is not true. And that like the changing the rate of the camera suddenly transforms a very slow process into an immediate apparent process. So actually, this tremendous motion is going on, but it is so slow that we do not notice it. But in the great unfoldment of the blaze of eternity itself, this motion is probably, in reality, far more rapid than we realize. This bursting through of totality, the complete conquest of otherness by reality itself, was to these people, these philosophers, the condition most greatly to be desired. And in the practice of theurgy, as we have said, they taught certain cathartic disciplines, disciplines of purification, disciplines of instruction. They believed in teacher-student relationships, not because the teacher was wise or the student was foolish, but because of an experience. That the experience of relationship, the man, individual who could learn to follow the teacher, could sometime learn to obey God. And the teacher did not claim to be God or to hold any ancient or sacred prerogatives, but the individual who cannot obey can never lead successfully or securely. So all through their disciplines, they set up patterns, not for the sake of forms, but for the sake of enriching or strengthening the inner character and attributes of the individual. And they went on from these disciplines of purification to disciplines of meditation and enlightenment, seeking always the highest good as it was attainable to them. One modern writer who was not particularly favorable to these older philosophers, as is often the case, however, did summarize one statement not long ago when he said, whatever we may say or think, we cannot question the magnificent ethics promulgated and taught by these people, an ethics which probably is one of the highest in the history of philosophy, because these people made so much of the fact. In fact, their whole philosophy was suspended from the one fact that philosophy was not a way of thinking. Philosophy was not an accumulation of knowledge. Philosophy was an experience of life. So are the quotations, make philosophy thy life. Not the subject of analysis or concentration or something of that kind alone. The ethical structure of the Neoplatonists, therefore, is of some advantage to us to know exactly how they proceeded in their general contemplation. They held on the religious level that the greatest possible good was to discover the oneness, the complete indivisible wholeness of all human religions, that all religions, great and lesser, enlightened and unenlightened, represented degrees of the human quest for totality, for wholeness, for escape from otherness into the sphere of reality. Therefore, their absolute patience with all religions, and at the same time, their very sincere and definite desire to assist the release of the highest ethical and moral principles within these different religious groups. Plotinus says, they held philosophy to be a great discipline of the mind, by which the mind could be brought to that realization of the reality of universals, that they might, or the mind itself, might then abide in perfect childlike faith in the realities of eternity. Like Socrates and Plato, therefore, the mind prepared the individual for the perfect faith, hope, and love, because it proved to him the kind of a world in which he lived, and enabled him to trust his eternal destiny without hesitation, without reservation, without mental limitation, to the infinite keeping of the infinite good. Of morality, their doctrines would be as high as any that we have today. And for their general code, they were greatly indebted to the great Egyptian negative confession of faith, which they were able to contact, presumably, through the Hermetic mysteries. And of course, the Egyptian negative confession of faith is probably the greatest moral document on earth. It is a document so incredible that we wonder that the Egyptian could accept it or even formulate it under oath, because it is a type of thing that would be almost impossible for modern man to live up to. And yet it was not only inscribed in the mortuary rites, but because these rites were of the highest significance, the individual, in order to escape the implications of this, would have to stand prepared to perjure himself in the afterlife before God. And it is a little difficult to imagine that he would dare, under the existing state of his religion, to assume such a thing. It is not often that we see a complete statement of this as we find it in the early Hermetic works, but for the original contains over 300 sections and constitutes an incredible moral code. But I remember three or four thoughts in connection with it, which were moved into Neoplatonism to become the basis of what they call the philosophic life. For as I believe, if I am correct, it was Proclus who said, philosophy is nothing more than doing good. And then he adds, and to do good exhausts the power of philosophy. Because everyone in the world desires to do good, but very few know how. But in the event, the negative confession of faith includes such statements as the person standing before the great God, and with all the gods of the balance before him, surrounded by the rulers of the quick and the dead, in the great hall of Amenhotep, and the soul of the deceased addressing Osiris of the double empire, plumed and robed. The soul says, never during my earthly life did I say an unkind word about any person. Never in my life did I bring injury to the living or the dead. Never did I covet that which was not my own. Never did I raise my voice against my friend or my enemy. Now, if you go through 300 clauses of that kind, it must have been a little difficult to get into a mention. Now, of course, we can say that nobody ever lived that way, and that such a code is inconceivable. Granted that the Egyptian did not, but Plotinus and the Neoplatonists would point out a very simple thing. It was that power which was without otherness that made him dream and hope that he could. In other words, this code came from the eternal root. It came from something perhaps so great within himself that he could not even live it. He could never really transcend his own frailties to that degree. But it was this root beyond otherness that made him hope or dream that such virtues could be, or even to recognize such conduct as a virtue, because all men have not. It was also this root within him which made him dream of a time to come in which such a code could be real, and men could live this way. So it was, as Plotinus points out, proof that the supreme preceptor, the grand hierophant of all mysteries, the teacher of teachers, lies in the total being of the individual himself. That in proper need, in proper humility, in proper grace of spirit, man becoming still and learning through stillness to know, could bridge the mysterious otherness and find the eternal root and core of all good, all beauty, and all truth locked within his own soul. And that this great road past the otherness was the road of contrition, of dedication, of devotion, service, and love. These things were greatly known by these people. And I suppose there is no group of philosophy in the Western world that made as heavy an emphasis upon human regard, friendship, affection, love, service, as this Neoplatonic school. To them, it was one of the essential disciplines of their religion. Something not to be discussed, not necessarily to be advised, not even to be advocated, but simply, naturally, and without reservation to be applied. Not to be considered as a virtue, for Plotinus felt definitely that man's growth is not to be considered as a virtue, but as the simple expression of an eternal necessity within himself. Man is not to be complimented because he grows, because growth is his natural way. And it is when he does not grow that he should be distinguished as in some way different and inferior to the order of life to which he belongs. Therefore, his growth is his fulfillment, his natural and reasonable course of action. And on this ground, he is here to fulfill, to develop, and to perfect himself. Plotinus says that during his lifetime, he was on 6 occasions elevated into theurgic identity with a blessed being. He tells us that this particular mystery is not to be explained, but that during these exaltations of consciousness, he was able to experience fully the complete meaninglessness of himself. That he was able to discover and experience that truly he was a word spoken by an infinite power. That in himself he was nothing, but that the great God in him did the work. And that in this relationship, he was not only the willing hand, the willing servant, but that it was not even a servitude, because it was a realization of an identity that was so transcendent, so complete, and so immeasurable, that he was nothing and all. That he was not superior to the least nor inferior to the greatest. That he was totally alike, and that there was no longer any interval between himself and that which was infinitely less or infinitely greater. Now, the degree of the exact enlightenment we do not know, but we know that it became the foundation of the entire theurgical art, which was to achieve the experience so that nothing is great nor small, but all things are true. And in their being true, they are not truth in the sense of fact. They are truth in the sense of radiant, living being. For to all these ancients of this school, every reality was a radiant, living archetype. Not a fact, but a magnificent, blazing entity. A tremendous mathematical formula ensouled by a divine power. And the perfection of the formula called that power by an enchantment. And that which is built in a certain pattern calls to itself the soul that is to inhabit it, like the urns that were fashioned by Omar the tent maker, each of which spoke with a voice according to its own nature. So in the Neoplatonic concept, we find this sense of illumination as being identity with the least and the greatest, without interval or difference. Plotinus pointed out that these experiences for man, for the average man, can last only for a few seconds, because beyond that point, the tremendous and incredible bewilderment, the incredible radiance, would be more than the human personality can endure. Therefore, for a second, this tremendous blaze is released like baby's lightning flash, and then the curtain falls again, and the individual lives once more in the peculiar uncertainties of the mortal sphere. But these experiences are that which is beyond otherness, result in the sudden recognition that we are everything and everything is us. There is no interval, there is no difference, there is no time. There is simply the incredible ability to experience the entire impact of creation as a mystery of the eternal will and the eternal love. These things then made the peculiar school that flourished in this sad and visible transition period, that it brought with it a tremendous strength of inner conviction, we know, that it has a short span of existence, we also know. For we know that after the death of Theon of Alexandria, Hypatia took the chair of philosophy in the Neoplatonic Academy and was later assassinated. The murder of Hypatia closed the Alexandrian school. The death of Proclus probably, approximately, terminated the school in Athens, because after that time, his disciples were scattered and forced to flee into other lands. In Rome, the school practically ended with the death of Plotinus. So the Neoplatonic school did not live long in its strange, mysterious effort to explain chaos. The chaos of the Roman Empire, the chaos of Egypt and of Greece, by discovering, by a valiant extension of inward life, the immense reality which would justify chaos and would make it ultimately the instrument and servant of the great ordering power of an eternal good. These philosophers left their mark upon history. Their school of thought descended and has survived. We know, for example, the important part they played in the great statutes of St. Augustine. We know furthermore that they were tremendously powerful in shaping the whole great theological system of Thomas Aquinas. We know that they came on down through practically all the systems of idealistic philosophy, all the way down to our own Emerson. Nearly all mystics of the medieval Christian period, both Catholic and Protestant, were by nature and by, in many cases, by pronouncement, Neoplatonists. They were able to be this because the Church did not deny them that right. It did not hold up this one system to ridicule or general refutation. It was acknowledged and occurs again and again. In the Eastern Church, the mystical divinity of Dionysus Areopagitus dominated the entire Eastern Church and became part of the tradition which descended with St. Chrysostom. In the West, we have other equal mystics, some of the more famous, of course, St. Buenaventura, St. Francis de Assis, and others, all of whom carried the same mystical divinity concept with them, and it is still essentially a part of church dogma. Thus, the influence of the situation is reflected, perhaps, in the orders of penance, in some of the monastic orders of early Christianity, because of the effort to escape otherness and to lay a foundation for crossing the interval between human limitation and universal and eternal life. And all of these systems are related in this transition. We know, for instance, that Aquinas specifically and definitely mentions these other authors and is indebtedness to them. It is not theory, it is factually there. So that we have a tremendous moral descent of Neoplatonism. And I think perhaps it can be also summarized in the approved definition of mysticism as it is known in the classical world and in the modern world of mature philosophical thinking. And that is, mysticism is the belief or the conviction of the availability of the presence of the divine, and that the individual seeking within himself and unselfishly and impersonally desirous and solicitous of inner instruction will receive it, and that this instruction is possible because of the omnipotence, omnipresence, and omniactivity of the divine power, which is without boundary or limitation, and is the supreme or tremendous unity, and is the tremendous archetypal impulse behind all creatures seeking wholeness and seeking to return again like Ulysses to their own far distant native land. And as we go on with this series, we will also have a little time to consider the wandering of Odysseus and other phases of this subject, the Porphyry's Cave of the Nymphs, and Socrates, Apuleius on the God of Socrates. Then we will mention them in connection with other things. But I think perhaps this will give us a little picture of the contribution that was made by the work of Iamblichus on the Mysteries, which is the basic concept on which we have been working tonight, the concept of theurgy. And we will pass on in the next instruction to another phase of Neoplatonic discipline. And thank you very much for